And thanks again to Eric's Red, helps open a meeting, doing a reading. And I'll take this opportunity to welcome any folk that have joined us since we first started. I'd like to extend a hand of welcome to anyone that's new to the meeting tonight. Any visitors from other places? I see a couple of names, Fordyce and Andrew, that I don't recognise. So welcome, we're glad you're here. Huge welcome to anybody that's coming back tonight or a newcomer to Narcotics Anonymous. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So, like I said, this is a speaker meeting, and it falls on me to introduce our speaker tonight. Not sure what to say about David, really. We've known each other a while through a mutual social media place. I know him as a kind, compassionate, and caring human being. Takes his membership and his participation in this program very seriously, and he was willing to step up and be of service to us a couple of weeks ago when we didn't have a speaker, and we managed to get someone to fill. And since then, I said, "Well, come along, share for us another day," and he did. So he's here to share his experience, strength, and hope, his journey into and through Narcotics Anonymous for the next 40-45 minutes. I'm looking forward to hearing his story. I know he's been around fellowship for a fair old while. I'll leave it to him to share that if he chooses to. So, David, the floor is yours, my friend. Please share with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Hey, my name is Dave. I'm an addict.
Hey,
Hello, Dave.
Dave.
Hello, Dave.
Hey.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm grateful to be here at a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. Grateful to be clean today. Grateful to see all your beautiful faces. And I'm just wondering right now how many of you are checking the camera button or the settings on your app there. And thank you, Steve, for inviting me to speak here. It's always an honor and a pleasure to speak at a meeting. Whenever I'm asked to speak, I try to set an intention, and that's to carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous. And that message is that an addict, any addict, can quit using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way of life. So I guess I'm going to start with what kind of addict am I? And excuse me. Get one or two key things out of the way. I know whenever I'm listening to a speaker, I sit there because I have an overactive mind, and I sit there and I listen for, okay, how old is this person? When did they get clean? Where are they from? So I'll just get to that. I'm 61 years old. My birthday's near the end of August, and I got clean on May 4th, 1989, which makes me 32 years, 10 months, and one day clean, I believe, last time I checked. I believe that makes me 11,965 days. So in March, I know we'll hopefully, God willing, have 12,000 days clean. And the thing is, that's an awful lot of time. That's more time than most people. Not as much as some people, but that's more time than most people. But I am an addict, and I know I'm an addict. And despite all that time since my last high, I am no farther from my next high than anybody else in this program. Because there's a liquor store just a few blocks away from here. And a couple blocks down from that, there's a pot shop, because yes, pot is legal here in Colorado. And just another mile down the road is the bridge where the junkies hang out. It's not that hard. It's just not that hard. And so I have to stay vigilant. I have to keep working steps. I have to keep going to meetings. I have to continue to be of service. And I'd like to say what that really means. And that is, I get to keep going to meetings. I get to keep working steps, and I get to be of service. I get to have people in my lives. I get to sponsor people. I think one of them might be here today. So that's kind of what kind of an addict I am now, and that's a lot about about kind of my philosophy in a very general sense. But what kind of addict was I? You know, it says any addict. What kind of addict was I back in the day? Well, I was your basic garden variety suburban stoner. I, you know, my first use was 10 years old. It was communion wine. It was not communion. I came from a violent home, verbally abusive, emotionally abusive, emotionally neglectful, and smothering at the same time, which is actually a form of neglect and violent. And, you know, some of that violence happened when I was very young. Anyway, and I'll get to that, you know, that's not, I couldn't control that, you know, I couldn't do anything about that. I inventoried my resentments around that. I've inventoried my resentments around that a few times over the course of the last, you know, three decades. And, you know, I can't control that. I'm not responsible for that, but I am responsible for my recovery. You know, I'm an adult, I'm a grown up, you know, and I need to take care of me because that stuff affects me now. So I was a garden variety suburban stoner, you know, alcohol, pot, LSD, the occasional black tar opium, and whatever else I would try from time to time. But those four things were kind of the main things for me. And it really doesn't matter because, you know, I could call any one of those things a drug of choice. But the truth is there was no drug of choice. It was a drug of no choice. And what that means for me is that when I had it, I had no choice. I had to use it. And when I didn't have it, I had no choice. I had to find it. And when I couldn't find it, I had no choice. I had to find something else. And it didn't matter what that was. It didn't. And there were times when I did stuff that I really didn't like doing, that I didn't want to do. But I did them because no choice. There were times when, you know, I remember me and a buddy would sit there in my apartment and going, okay, well, you don't have any coke. I don't have any, because I didn't like coke. I don't have any acid. Neither of us have any pot. Shit, we're going to have to get drunk. Going to have to, you know, and that was the deal. And sometimes that led to violence, and sometimes that just, you know, led, most of the time it led to me sitting there by myself. You know, a lot of times I'd be sitting there by myself, and I try to stop, I try to control it. I remember sitting there in my living room, and I'd be watching TV, and I'd say to myself, okay, tonight I'm not going to do it. I had it, but I'm not going to do it tonight. You know, I'm just going to sit here, watch TV, and then go to bed. And the news came, I'll watch the weather. You know, I'll watch the sports. I want to see what the Cincinnati Reds did. I grew up in Cincinnati, and that's where I used, and that's where I got clean. I'll watch Johnny Carson, Tonight Show. That's how old I am. That's a long, long time ago, popular late night talk show here. And, you know, then I watch the next show. And then finally, okay, that's it. I'm getting up. I'm going to go to bed. And all I had to do was get up, make a little U-turn, walk down the hall and get in bed. But that's not what I did. I'd get up and I would walk right over to the coffee table, open the drawer, pull out the tray, and I'd be after it till 4 in the morning or so. Till I was calm and comfortable and didn't have that itch to scratch, because that's what it was like. It was an itch. You know, I would sit there that whole night acknowledging that I had this itch and not going to do it, not going to do it this time. And it didn't seem to matter. It never seemed to matter. There was this thing I really liked to do, still like to do. There's this band that I used to like to follow and still do, actually, again. I guess I just talk more. I go back and forth on this when I'm sharing my story, because it's like, well, is this an outside issue? No, this is impacting me. So I'm very, very much into the Grateful Dead. I am a Deadhead, and I used to travel around the country following them around to go see their concerts. And boy, oh boy, are there a lot of drugs on that scene. And I had this idea in my head that there was because where else would I have an idea, right? There was absolutely no way I could get clean because I couldn't stop going to those shows. I didn't see how, because I knew that if I stopped going to those shows, I would never be happy. Absolutely never be happy. And that there was no way I could stay clean and do that at the same time. And there, that was another itch to scratch, I guess. And it was something I loved. It was a spiritual reset every time I was there. And so my sister got clean in 86, February 26th, 1986. She's still 3 years ahead of me. So she has, oh gosh, what is it, 35 years, coming up on 36 years here, God willing, in a few weeks. It's me. It's still late morning here, and my throat's a little scratchy, and it's very, very dry here in Colorado. So she got clean. She got clean before I did, because she refers to it as sober because, you know, she started going to AA. And I'd never heard of NA. I'd never heard of NA until I had 6 years clean. Okay. Late in my using, I was pretty despondent, and she had started working on me. She had a few years at that point, and she found that there was this group of deadheads, this group of people who followed this band who were clean. And they were supporting each other. And I wanted to know about that, I think. Or she's like, here's a number. You should check this out. You should call them. So after sitting on that number for about 6 weeks, and continuing to use, and at that point, I had decided that I wasn't going to use drugs anymore, what I thought of drugs, and I was only going to drink, not realizing, of course, actually kind of realizing, understanding, but it was legal liquid drugs. And so I was doing that, and it was getting bad. It was really bad. And I called this number, and that person wasn't really the person to talk to, but she knew the people to talk to, and I called them, and we talked. And it was this couple lived way out on the east side of Cincinnati. And what I didn't know at the time is that they are actually the co-founders of this group, this fellowship called Wharf Rats, which has a few thousand, several thousand members, and whose influence has extended into many areas. But they are not a 12-step group. They are not. What they do is they provide meetings, they provide traction and fellowship in an otherwise slippery place, you know, a place for recovering addicts to go, you know, it's like a clubhouse or, you know, whatever. There's those kinds of organizations. And so I started hanging out at their house, and what I saw was a couple who were not white knuckling it through life, who were clearly enjoying the music, who were clearly doing the deal with that, but also staying clean and living what I thought was a pretty good life. You know, it was very attractive. And, you know, it brings me to our third step prayer, you know, take my will in my life, guide me in my recovery, and show me how to live. I'd never heard that prayer till I had probably about 7 years, 7-8 years clean. But clearly God was answering that prayer. My higher power was answering that prayer 2 months before I got clean. He was showing me how to live. And, you know, Somebody last year, I heard something in a meeting. Somebody said that I really liked. When I hear something in a meeting I really like, I write it down. And what he said was that a prayer is not so. A prayer is so that you know what you want to ask for. God already knows, and God already knew what I wanted or what I needed, and so he was showing me how to live. And I guess he took my will in my life because I sure as hell wasn't going to give it. But things kept getting worse and worse and worse. And, you know, it came to the end where I had no money, and I wanted to call somebody. I didn't have a phone, and I lived on this steep hill, and there was a phone booth, a payphone down at the bottom. For the younger people out there, there's these telephones that you put money into, and then you can make a call. I actually walked down the hill to this phone and panhandled for money so I could make a phone call. And I ended up not being able to get any. And that last night, I was standing there in my kitchen, and I had a bottle of sake all alone. And I hate sake. That is nasty stuff. But this was a freebie from somebody. And I stood there looking at this going, God, I hate this stuff. Oh, God, right out of the bottle. And I drank the whole thing down in, I don't know, 10 minutes, whatever it took for me to go, oh, God, that's nasty. And at the end, I didn't get a thing. I mean, I had, you know, I could tell I had drank something, but I guess my tolerance level was so damn high at that point that I just, it did nothing. And I had nothing else, and I had no money, and I had nobody I could turn to. And it got down to the point where it was just me and me. And that's a bad place to be. And it's a good place to be because it left me in a state of desperation. So my sister was out of town, went out of town, and she loaned me her car for the time. I'm sitting there for those few days with this car, but no money, no place to go. I had a little 20-hour-a-week minimum wage job that I could tell the end was near. They didn't really like me that much. And I went through like a dozen jobs in about 6-7 years. And so I picked her up at the airport, her and her friend. We dropped her friend off. As soon as the car door shut from her walking her friend to the door, I said to her, I want you to take me to a meeting. So she took me to this meeting, maybe the next day. And it was a Friday night meeting. It was an AA meeting. Again, I never heard of NA. And so it's all alcoholics, right? But I use drugs. And so she says, I want you to wait here by the door. There's somebody I want you to meet. And so I'm standing there waiting at the door, looking in, you know, what kind of an exclusive club is this that you got to wait by the door or whatever. And so she comes back and she says, Dave, this is Jay. He's an addict just like you. Now, that stuck with me clearly because here, almost 33 years later, I'm still talking about it. I would ponder that from time to time. I didn't really know what it meant, except it meant that I was okay. I was accepted there. There were people like me there. And I'm sitting down there. I'm sitting in a meeting. First of all, when she introduced me, I thought, boy, this guy looks familiar. And we're sitting there at this round table in this meeting. There was like a couple of rows of round tables and people sitting around them. And we're sitting there talking. Jay's on my right, and I look over to the left, and Jay says something. I immediately knew who he was. And he's somebody I knew of professionally, but not didn't know in person. But I greatly admired his work from a professional standpoint. And I didn't let on that I knew who Jay was. I don't think. I don't know when it was. But anyway, the meeting starts, and And does anybody have a topic? Jay's hand goes right up and he says, hey, I just celebrated a year and I'm really struggling. And I don't understand why. And so he spoke and nobody else said anything while he talked. And then the next person talked and nobody else talked. And I started to notice this pattern. One, they were able to talk about what was going on for them. They were able to talk about how they felt. I wasn't even really in touch with how I felt. And they were, but the other thing is they were able to talk and nobody would interrupt them, which certainly never happened when I was growing up. I mean, I almost never felt like I could finish a sentence, which is why I love getting 40 to 45 minutes to speak, because I can finish a lot of sentences. And also they liked each other and they were happy and they weren't white knuckling it through life. I mean, even Jay, who had a year and was miserable, or really suffering, didn't seem like he was white knuckling it through life. He was just kind of in an emotionally tough place. You know, I'm very pleased to say that was almost 33 years ago. Jay is still 1 year ahead of me, and he's still one of my best friends. And you know, last year we went to Cincinnati to go see my family. It's a 2-day drive from here. And I put it out there on Facebook that I was coming to Cincinnati, and I don't think it was even 60 seconds before he responded with, "We're getting together, right?" You know, I never had friends that I made like that, that stuck and stayed, that were in my life like that. And, you know, when I was in addiction, I'd lost everything, all the big stuff, you know, trust in a higher power, any sense that I had any kind of control, belief that I could make a difference to anyone. I lost that. Boy, I sure got that back. Regard for anybody else's well-being, any sense of who I am. I don't know that I ever actually had that. Any dignity and self-respect, that sure was gone. Hope of any sort and a desire to keep living. I didn't believe I could get clean. I didn't believe I would ever lose the desire to use, but I did. And that's the beauty of our message, that we can quit using drugs, that we can lose the desire to use. These people were not white-knuckling it through life. They were living happy, joyous, and free. Yeah, they were struggling sometimes, and I got to see that at my first meeting. But they had a way to deal with it that I didn't have other than using. Because you see, when it gets right down to it, that's why I use. I used at these very specific times, and those times were Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, in the mornings, at lunchtime, in the afternoons, at dinner time, in the evenings, and late at night and overnight. And on holidays and weekends and weekdays and work or no work or whatever. That's the only times I ever used. And you know, I'd use when I was happy. I'd use when I was sad. I'd use when really bad stuff would happen. I'd use when things were going great. You know, I'd celebrate whatever was going on by using. And what I come down to is that I am an addict, and that's exactly why I used. When I see people relapse, you know, we talk through it and we talk through it. And over the years, I've come to realize that the stories are all different, but they all have one thing in common, and that is they used. You know, that somebody may have died or they may have gotten really successful and drifted away from the program. But whatever it is, we use. And, you know, there's the three disturbing realizations, and the third one starts, and those are on page 15 of the basic text, and the third one starts with, we can no longer blame people, places, and things for our addiction. And that's right, you know. My brother is not an addict. It doesn't even occur to him to drink or to use or whatever when there's difficult times. As a matter of fact, it's like the last thing he wants to do. He tried, at my dad's retirement party, he sat across the table from me and tried to match me drink for drink. And that lasted about, he didn't get through the fourth drink. You know, it's not about, it's not at all about all that other external stuff. It's about what happens inside. And by going to meetings and starting to work steps, I got to see that I could deal with that stuff inside. The meetings I was going to, and this is the other thing I got from being introduced to a guy who I was told is an addict just like me, is that these meetings I was going to, unlike a lot of those AA meetings, there were a lot of addicts going to meetings in that neighborhood. There were people claiming relapses on coke and pills and pot and all the things I used. And you know, and of course alcohol. And honestly, and they were talking about the disease of addiction. And the more I look back on it, the more I realize that those were NA meetings in disguise. You know, those were just like NA meetings. And I got what I needed. I worked steps. I was of service. I kept coming to meetings. I got a higher power in my life. I came into that with power of my mother's understanding, and she was a hellfire and brimstone fundamentalist Christian from West by God, Virginia. You know, good old Appalachian. Christianity. Anyway, who said that I must fear God, that God is up there writing down every little thing I did and was going to damn me to hellfire for what I had done. But he loves me. Right. So I didn't want anything to do with that God, but that was all I knew. So I decided to just not worry about what God was. I was just going to do this work. I was just going to do the serenity prayer. I was just going to connect through working the steps and not worry about God. And I went back to engineering school a few years into my recovery. And of course, starting to study the math, and I remembered and realized that there are undefined terms in there. We would not have this ability to have these long distance meetings, nor would we have electricity in our homes without undefined terms, without imaginary numbers and undefined numbers. We wouldn't have that. And if that works in a scientific and mathematical world, well, it can work in a spiritual world, because, you know, our book says that if a solution is not practical, it's not spiritual. And so that's kind of the approach I went with, was I don't have to define this. I can just keep working this and whatever it is. And I found something later that I was able to define. You know, and that new way to live, you know, I was told I had to be willing. I went to my first clean Grateful Dead concert at like 75 days clean. And people were telling me, oh, you don't want to do that. You don't want to be around that. But what I was also told was, you know, there's this thing I hear in meetings sometimes that the only thing you have to change is everything. But they didn't tell me that. Basically, they said you're not capable of changing anything. But you just have to be willing to change anything that gets in the way. You know, just have that willingness and connect with a higher power and get to meetings and work steps. And, you know, I found I can go a long way on willingness. And I went to that meeting and I had support. I had these wharf rats by me, you know, and by the way, their influence has spread to the point where at Green Bay Packers home games, American football home games, they now have a table of a wharf rat, of a group based on wharf rats for people who don't want to drink or get high at the game. You know, this thing has become ubiquitous, and I've found that I can go anywhere if I am doing this program, working my steps, staying connected. But if I'm not doing that, there's no place I can hide from my disease. There's no place I can hide from the disease of addiction. And that higher power was crucial to me. You know, I had about a year and a half, more than a year and a half, and Valentine's Day was coming up. So I guess that would have been about 31 years ago this week. 31 years ago this week, next week. And I'm sitting there at this meeting on Valentine's Day, lonely and in despair and really pretty inconsolable. And I got up in the middle of the meeting and left. And as I'm driving home, I'm mentally counting the money in my pocket to see how much I could buy, how much alcohol I could buy. At that point, I didn't really know anybody who was selling anything else, but you know, I knew I could buy alcohol and, you know, drug of no choice. If I can't find anything else, there you go. And I'm on my way to go do that, but my car somehow went to my apartment and my body somehow went into my apartment and went to bed. And I got up the next morning very puzzled, and I called my sponsor, who, by the way, was an atheist and very, very passionate about being an atheist. And I said to him, I don't understand, Al. I don't get it. I was on my way to go get loaded, but my body and my car just seemed to come back. And he said, God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And that was a remarkable coming from him. You know, I had this thing happen where my mother decided to have elective surgery on Christmas Eve so that she could make herself the center of attention. You know, you're all going to have to take care of me, and, you know, me, very, very self-centered. Sound familiar? She's one of us. She was one of us. Only she never made it to the rooms. Anyway. I go to my home group. I'm sitting there, and I had a different sponsor at this point. I had a guy named Ken, and I'm sitting there complaining about this, and I'm angry and I'm upset and I don't know what to do, and I'm going to have to spend my Christmas taking care of her, and I don't want to. And I finish talking, and my sponsor speaks up next, and he's sitting kind of across the table from me, and he puts his elbow on the table, points at me, leans forward and says, make your own damn Christmas. And he went on to explain how he and his wife made their own Christmas, how they decided what they were going to do, who they were going to do it with, who they were going to go see, how long they were going to stay, and basically take control of that. And I realized that I could make my own damn life, that I could make my decisions for me. Again, I'm a grown-up. Another beautiful thing happened. There was this couple in the meeting, these two women. After the meeting, they came up to me and they said, you're coming to our house for Christmas. You know, right after I find out I could decide, they come up to me and you are coming to our house for Christmas. And I did. And I got there and they said, we're going to love you until you can love yourself. That was the best Christmas I've ever had to this day. I was in school. I was going to meetings. Doing all that stuff. I was having trouble getting my step work done. I was having trouble getting the writing done. And so, again, different sponsor. I was changing sponsors a lot. And to this day, I still, every time I start a new set of steps, I get a new sponsor to take me through. And so I would sit there and at home, like, okay, I'd find anything else to do. And I'd call my sponsor, a guy named Lee. And I would say, Lee, I don't get it. I don't know what I can't get writing, and, you know, and he'd listen and, well, you know, you could try this or that, whatever. And at some point I realized that every time I called him, he's sitting at home watching TV. You know, we didn't have cell phones at that time. We didn't have mobile phones. We all had landlines, and he's sitting there watching TV. If I call him and I get him, he's at home. And so I said, hey, Lee, can I come over to your house while you're watching TV and sit at your dining room table and work on my step work? He's like, oh, yeah, sure. So I started doing that, and I did that at least once a week, couple times a week. That ended up becoming something much bigger later after I moved here. Back in 81, I got engaged to this woman. We were going to get married. Things were looking great, and then she got pregnant, and we got really scared and a lot of doubt, and what do we do and how are we going to do it? And then she had a miscarriage and we were devastated, and we ended up breaking up from that. And using played a big, big part in everything, probably played a part in her miscarriage. And I didn't see her. I hadn't seen her for like 13 years. And I saw her in a restaurant, working in a restaurant one Friday night. And she didn't see me, and I got out of there, and I had her on my amends list. like, damn, what do I do? What do I do? And I don't want to, I'm afraid to go talk to her. Some months, that was in 95. That was in spring of 95. Summer of 95, I went on a three-week road trip. I ended up in Albuquerque, New Mexico at one point. Now, I had been in therapy over this miscarriage at this point because I was a little healthier then, right? You know, I'm doing things to get healthy. And I say to, you know, we're talking about it, my therapist says, maybe what you need to do is name this child, this son. We knew it was a boy. It was that far along. And he said, I couldn't think of a name. And he said, well, I had a couple who called theirs Phoenix after, you know, a bird that rises up out of the ashes. And I said, well, maybe I should name this one Albuquerque. Well, I got to Albuquerque on this long road trip, and I went to a cemetery there, and I made amends to Albuquerque, my son, my miscarried son who never got to really be born and breathe or live, who would be in his coming up on his 40s here right about now, on 40. And so that was life changing. I got back, I fell in love, things are going great. It was a glorious summer. Jerry Garcia died. That was really tough. I was devastated. He was the lead guitarist for the Grateful Dead, and I was devastated. But see, I skipped summer tour that summer to go on this 3-week road trip. I didn't, you know, because I had willingness. I got to be at a place where I was okay. I didn't have to not go. I got to not go and do something else instead. And so that was tough, but you know, I've got the tools, right? I can do this. And a few weeks later, that this woman I was seeing, beautiful, beautiful, much too young for me woman, was killed in a boating accident. And I went right back into the depression I had been in before that got me into therapy. And I ended up having to drop out of school because, well, I flunked out is what happened. I was a Dean's List student. I was an A student in engineering. I was crushing it. And when that happened, I couldn't get out of bed. I would literally lay there in bed while the alarm clock is going off, and I wouldn't get up to get that. I don't know where I'm at in time, by the way. Oh, geez. Okay. I wrote a letter. I went out to the restaurant where she worked, and I left it for her. She wasn't there. And a couple months later, a few months later, on Valentine's Day, she called me. And she was married, had a couple kids at that point. And we ended up getting together, and I made amends, and I had my little index cards, which I still do. And afterwards, I told her about Albuquerque as well. And afterwards she said, okay, that stuff on your cards, I don't care about that. You don't owe me an amends for that. But that stuff about Albuquerque, that's what I came here to hear. And I got free, and we got free. And at that point, I realized my work in Cincinnati, my business in Cincinnati was done. And I decided to move here to Denver. I was talking to a friend, a deadhead friend, not in the program. And we're talking about this. And I said, yeah, I'm going to temp. I'm going to go out there. And she says, oh, I know a guy out there about your age, couple kids, doesn't party, runs a temp agency and a deadhead. I'm like, huh, okay. He's into this music. He's into that scene, but he doesn't party. He's got to be a war friend. He's got to be in the program. He's got to be, you know, doing that. And so I said to her, could you give me his number or have him call me or ask if I can call him? Yeah, sure. 10 minutes later, we finish our call. About 10 minutes after that, the phone rings. It's him. And what happened on her end was she finished the call with me, set the phone down, started to turn around. The phone rang. She picked it up, and it was him. And that was God acting in my life, I believe. I could justify it any other way, but I choose to see that as God acting in my life. I'm going to skip ahead. I got here. I was still doing AA, but I had heard about NA. And Steve, this friend of mine here in Denver, was in NA, this guy that I had met through her. And he's still a very close friend. And And I started going to NA. And I started working steps in NA. And again, I was having trouble getting through my work. And I thought back to what I was doing with Lee and going over to his house. And I said to my buddy, Don, my roommate, Don, at that point, hey, why don't we start a writing meeting? This was in 2003. And so we started a meeting where we did a few readings. And then we had 30 minutes of quiet time with a timer to write on our step work, and then took a break, and then came back and had open discussion of any related topics. And that was great. And but it was on a night when there were a lot of other meetings, and it was in a location nobody knew. No, there were no other NA meetings there. And it was just in a weird location, and it just didn't work. And after a year and a half, the meeting fizzled out. And, you know, so I'm going along, things are happening. And sure enough, here it comes again. I can't get my writing done. And so I go to my sponsor. I don't know what to do. What I'd really like to do is start another writing meeting. Now, this was a little over 9 years ago. And he said, well, why don't we? So actually, I think he said was, I think you better. So we started a writing meeting, and he was there. Don was at that first meeting. There were seven people at that first meeting, and I used to say I knew four of them were, and I just found out this week who another one was. And so that meeting is called Writing to Freedom, WTF. And we met in this tiny little room at this church where there were two other NA meetings, and word started to get out and people started coming around. At some point, somebody said, I want to make this my home group. And, you know, we were just a meeting. And somebody else said, yeah, I want to make it my home group too. And so it became a home group, and more people started coming. We had to go to a bigger room. And there we are in this big room. And then we celebrated, what was it, like 5, 6 years, something like that. We have a pizza party. 50 people showed up at that. And we were getting 20, 25 people a night showing up at this thing. And we'd sit there and work on our step work. And it was amazing. And you know, once the pandemic started, we had to go online. And that woman who said, I want to make this my home group, was at our 7-year anniversary party. And that was going to be her last because she was moving back to New Jersey. But that was like 2 weeks before everything shut down. And so so a few weeks later, here we are online, and I texted her and said, you thought you were out, you're in, here's the link. Come to Writing to Freedom. Well, we decided to stay online, and so we're still online. So Writing to Freedom, WTF, is still online, and anybody in the world can come to it. And we've had people from New Zealand who come to that meeting. You know, it's pretty cool. You know, people from all over the country, but a lot of people from Denver. We had 3/4 of the meeting was people from Denver, and then there are people from other places around the country and on the other side of the world. And that meeting is still going strong, and I am still going through my step work, and I am still growing and learning from that. A couple of years ago, I was at a meeting, a noon meeting, and there was a friend of mine there who we knew was terminally ill. He had come to terms with it, and he knew he only had months to live. And so we're talking, and he told me that he had just started a new set of steps. He's only got months to live, and he started a new set of steps. I'm like, what? And he says, well, yeah, you know, that's what I do. That's what I do. I'm an addict. That's what I do. And I realized I hadn't been, I had kind of stepped away from Writing to Freedom, which was a good thing because it shouldn't be the Dave show, right? And it had grown and it had flourished and it continues to flourish and it didn't need me. But I heard this guy with a few months to live. It turned out to be about 8 months to live. And here he was starting a new set of steps. And I said, I have no excuse. So the next Wednesday, which was Christmas, I went there and I was writing, and I was writing about what feelings, what do I fear? And I realized as I'm writing, I don't fear God. I was raised to fear God, and I don't fear God anymore. You know, and what a blessing that is. I can work with that. And I have been able to work with that. I'm on a seventh step right now. As I see it, a shortcoming is the empty space in a cup. And in order for me to remove that empty space, those shortcomings, I have to fill it with something in that spiritual principles. So that's what I'm working on. And that's what my sponsor has me working on. But a previous sponsor also had that philosophy. And that's what I teach my sponsees. And so I'm looking at spiritual principles. And the one thing that has become, and Steve, I'm so glad you mentioned this, because there's one thing, one spiritual principle that I value above all else, and that's kindness. And that was something I didn't have for a long time or never practiced, but wanted to or thought I did. And it's something that's really become a focus in my life. And that's a new way to live. All of this is a new way to live. I am looking at my little timer, and I see I'm at about 44 minutes, and I see we're coming up on the top of the hour. So I think I'm going to stop here. I just want to say thank you again. This has changed my life and continues to change my life. More than half of my life has been spent in recovery. And it's been the greatest thing that's ever happened to my life, because even though terrible shit happens, I can deal with it and I don't have to use. And life's all right. Life's great. I have so many people in my life that I love and that I'm there for and are there for me. And people call me to ask me for help. People call me. I can make a difference in other people's lives. And I know this because they keep calling me and asking me to. Anyway, that's all I have. Thank you so much. And God bless you all and take care. Thanks.